This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. A recent report from the University of North Carolina School of Law says that long-term solitary confinement is cruel, inhumane, and a degrading form of punishment. The report uses research and interviews with prisoners to examine the uses of solitary confinement, and it explains how it cannot be squared away with state, national, or international human rights laws. Here to talk about the report, Solitary Confinement as Torture, is the lead author, UNC Professor Deborah Weissman. Deborah, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So tell us a little bit, give us the bullet points, the executive summary of this report.
Yeah, well, the report identifies solitary confinement as a form of torture. Torture is the infliction of severe pain, be it physical or psychological, for the purposes of punishing an individual for something that they have done or are accused of doing. But it's punishment that's beyond the bounds of human decency. And we became interested in the issue in large part because of our work on torture in other contexts, particularly with regard to extraordinary rendition and torture, but also because there is a growing movement, a national movement, to look at the overuse of solitary confinement, its efficacy, and the consequences. And so we were inspired by the work that's happening on a national basis to take a look at the conditions, specifically here in North Carolina. In addition to the fact that solitary confinement, certainly for in excess of 15 days, constitutes torture as determined by, I guess I'd say, the best person to be an arbiter of what torture is, the special rapporteur on torture, it runs afoul of the best understanding of the Eighth Amendment. The Eighth Amendment jurisdiction in the United States is rather weak, but it is a standard that is tied to a notion of evolving standards of decency. And we know from the experts, the mental health experts and criminologists, that it's not likely, particularly the way it's practiced across the United States, to reduce prison disciplinary problems. And again, the consequences that flow from this practice are devastating. So we took a look at what was happening in North Carolina. The students who are great, who worked in this project, interviewed some individuals who were in solitary. We looked at narratives from other sources. We looked at what the experts say. We looked at other alternatives. And here we are with this report that says we need to think about what we're doing to individuals in prison, because what we're doing, as one of the folks we spoke with said, this is dehumanization by deprivation.
15 days is the definition. Beyond that is long term, but by the standard of this report, where does that number come from?
That number comes from first and foremost the rapporteur on torture, who testified to that.
And who is that?
His name is Juan Mendez.
And what is that position?
Well, he is designated by the United Nations as the individual to whom complaints and petitions would be directed with regard to torture on a global level. His determination that 15 days is the outset limit comes from studies and experts. I would not be surprised if, as we press on with more and more information, that time is shortened. We are aware of studies that show that even after hours, you can demonstrate neurological changes to the brain when somebody is held in circumstances of extreme sensory deprivation.
Did you do a comparison? How does North Carolina compare to the rest of the country? How does the U.S. compare to other countries?
We did a comparison primarily about the United States and the rest of – I'm sorry, North Carolina and the rest of the country. In most ways, we compare – we're very similar. It appears that our population of prisoners who are held in solitary is higher than other states. We know it's higher than New York, which has been sued successfully. We know it's higher than Texas. I believe it's higher than the statistics that students reviewed from the federal facilities. With regard to the conditions of confinement, I think they're generally pretty much the same, terrible, dehumanizing conditions. There are some states that have attempted to reform the use of solitary confinement, to curtail its use, to think about alternative, least restrictive settings in ways that I don't think North Carolina has gotten to. But It's a national problem, no doubt.
Let me ask you about this. Is it a matter of the conditions or simply the isolation? In other words, are there any conditions under which a person can be held in isolation, either as protection to themselves or the rest of the population, that would not be dehumanizing but isolating?
I think it's both. I think that we are human beings that are meant to have social interaction. And when you isolate somebody from human contact, that person's going to fall apart readily. We have stories about people who fell apart when a fly in their cell left. I know of people who talk about deep attachment to insects in their cell because of the need for some sort of human interaction. But the conditions are also so depraved. People are placed into cells that are not much bigger than parking spaces. They have no control over their environment. Oftentimes, the lights are blaring all the time. Oftentimes, the cells are, to say unsanitary is an understatement. Feces on the wall, particularly when you get to some of the higher levels of confinement, of punishment. Food is inedible in smaller quantities. But to the question, can somebody be held of necessity? And we would certainly concede there are some people who must be separated from the general population and who are a danger to themselves and clearly to correctional officers. There are ways to do that are stepped down, can be therapeutic, that do not have to be such total deprivation.
Well, the report emphasizes the psychological effects of solitary confinement. Brian Nelson is a man who spent 12 years in solitary at the Tams Supermax prison in Illinois. He spoke with Dick Gordon on the story 2 years ago about the challenges of adjusting to life after solitary confinement.
I knew what my out date was. And the sad part is, for almost a year before my release, I started asking people, are you going to help me get ready for this? I mean, I haven't been around somebody, and I had went to a court hearing in East St. Louis with my attorneys, Alan Mills, from the Uptown People's Law Center here.
Yeah.
And the magistrate had them take the cuffs off me. And I was allowed to shake Alan's hand. You know, and I break out in a sweat. I'm nervous. This is the first human contact I've had. I mean, my hands are free. I'm being treated like a person again. And the young lady clerk, you know, they're all looking at me like, are you okay? Because I'm looking at a flat screen TV, like, wow. I'm looking at a computer. It's like, this is a computer? And they're like, where you been, locked away in a cage? And I was like, basically, yeah. I mean, everything was a shock to me. And prior to release, I begged them, help me get ready. And at this time, I was on four different types of psychotropic medication. I mean, they were knocking me out every night just to make me sleep.
Brian Nelson never did have a chance to acclimatize himself to life outside the prison before he was released. He says instead, he was put in a holding cell with no shower and no contact for 28 days. And then they let him go.
I was scared. When they take me out to the gates, they finally take the chains off. My mother's looking at me like, what'd they do to you? And my picture looks so different because I hadn't shaved in almost a month. And I just looked grubby for not being able to shower. And then I had always wanted a Blizzard. So my mom took me to a Dairy Queen or Tasty Freeze, whatever it was. And somebody walked behind me. And I lost it. I mean, I lost it. I panicked. Get away from me, you know. And I throw my back up against the wall. I'm thinking this guy's going to attack me. I mean, people are getting too close for me. And I just literally lost it. I mean... here it is. I'm used to having my own space, being in a cell by myself all the time, and then people are just walking where they're touching me. And it scared the out of me. I mean, that's the only way to put it.
That's Brian Nelson. He spent 12 years in solitary confinement. He was talking with Dick Gordon on the story in 2012. Terry Coopers is here. He's a psychologist and a professor at the Wright Institute in Oakland, California. He's an expert on the psychological effects of prison conditions, including isolated confinement in supermax security units. Welcome to the show, Terry Coopers.
Hello. Very glad to be with you.
Good to talk with you. Also joining us is the former warden at the federal prison in Butner, North Carolina, Art Beeler. Art is currently leading a task force of outside experts to help North Carolina's Department of Public Safety improve the management of inmates with mental illness. Art, welcome back to the State of the Union. Good to have you.
Thank you, Frank.
Terry, let's talk about some of the psychological impact of isolation and solitary confinement. Can you tell us?
Well, first of all, anyone who spends a long time in solitary confinement is going to have a number of very troubling symptoms, including extreme anxiety, disordered thinking that tends towards paranoia, mounting anger, problems concentrating, problems with memory, and massive despair. Depression and suicide are just extremely prevalent in solitary confinement. 50% of all suicides in any prison system occur among the 5 or 7, or in North Carolina, it's 9% of people who are in solitary confinement. So it directly is a cause of suicide in prison, which is a very big mental health problem. Now, if you consider that kind of symptoms happening typically to people who are relatively stable mentally, if you put someone who is prone to mental illness, either psychosis, depression, or post-traumatic stress disorder, in that kind of a harsh environment that causes those kind of symptoms, that person is going to have a mental breakdown. And some of the worst cases of psychosis, depression, and despair that I've ever seen in my career have been people that I've interviewed in solitary confinement units around the country. The problem is the length of time. As Special Rapporteur Mendez of the United Nations said, anything longer than 15 days in solitary is a human rights abuse. And I think that's where we legitimately talk about torture. And the reason is because it causes severe damage, which is permanent. I have described this as the decimation of life skills. Besides the psychiatric symptoms that people experience while they're in isolation, and those are very severe and constitute torture, they also then are permanently damaged so that when they get out of prison, they're incapable of quality intimate relationships, of working, etc. And this I call the decimation of life skills, and it's really why long-term solitary confinement constitutes torture.
Art Beeler, why does an inmate get put into solitary confinement?
There's a number of reasons that a person ends into a restrictive housing. One is for their protection. Oftentimes you have people who, if you let them into the population, they could be victimized by others. One is for rule violations. And sometimes in a very small percentage of the time, you have people who are so violent and so dangerous that you can't let them into a population vis-a-vis you fear that they're going to harm somebody else.
You can hear from this report and from what Terry Coopers is saying that it's duration that really is an important factor here. Do you agree that there should be a limit to how long any inmate can be put into solitary?
Any good prison administrator wants to get people out as fast as they can. There's lots of reasons that you would like to do that. Number one is you want to get people back in the general population because you know they're going to function better in general population than in a segregated housing. Nobody's going to argue that. Not a competent prison administrator in the country will ever argue that. The other reason is, and from a practical standpoint, is cost. You know, nobody's mentioned that, but from a prison administration standpoint, it costs a whole lot more money to keep somebody in solitaire. And restrictive housing. I mean, it costs. You have staffing issues. You've got to take food service to them. You've got to take medical care to them. So you don't want to have those people in there if you can keep them from being in there. But to set a time frame is going to be difficult. And it's not the rule violators. You can set your policies to manage rule violators, whichever way you want to do it. It's those people who are so extraordinarily violent that you don't have places to put them. And it's those persons who are so liable to be victimized that if you place them in general population, that you're setting yourself up for, as a warden, you're setting yourself for not only the liability but the issues. I mean, there's a case called Farmer versus Brennan, which is a Supreme Court case out of 1995 that talks about deliberate indifference. And it talks about deliberate indifference from many different variations, but one of those is that if you know that somebody's going to be victimized – and you put them on the population and they get hurt, then you are responsible for that also. So there's lots of issues that go on in making these determinations. Restrictive housing needs to be examined. I don't think there's a good prison administrator that would tell you that it doesn't need to be examined. It does. It cannot become a crutch. It often has become a crutch by some people. And, you know, that's why you have to manage it.
Well, let me ask Terry Coopers about that management and something that you just heard Art Beeler say. For their own protections, there are cases in which individuals, for their own protection or the protection of others, need to be isolated. Terry?
Mr. Beeler makes a very good point, and that is that the responsibility of correctional administration is to keep people safe while they serve their term. And that means for both perpetrators and victims, there has to be special consideration that keeps the facility safe. What I would argue is that isolation is not necessary because isolation does so much harm. And what's needed is separation. Consider the person in protective custody. Yes, they need to be removed from the dangerous situation in the general population, either to move to another facility general population or to a special program that fits their needs. But when they're moved, they need to be separated from the source of the danger and provided with the programs and the social engagement that they're otherwise entitled to. Otherwise, they're going to be destroyed psychologically. The main issue, it seems to me, for corrections around the country is people have done a crime. Most people, some are innocent, but most people have done a crime, and we're punishing them for that. But more important, we need to think of how they're going to do when they get out of prison. And 95% of prisoners do eventually get out. And what we need to think about is whether what we do to them in prison harms them in such a way that they're more likely when they get out to return to substance abuse and crime. And solitary confinement, based on very good research, does that to people. So whether we're talking about the perpetrator of violence or the victim, it's a mistake to isolate them for any length of time. For 10 days, a couple of weeks, you know, as punishment for fighting or something is fine. But then what's needed is separation to provide safety without isolation so the person will not be broken down so that he or she will not be able to function when they get out of prison.
Well, Terry, let me stick with you for a second because the inmate Art describes, there's a couple of things. One, for their own protection. But if that person becomes so violent that they just cannot be managed any other way, it would seem to me, and you're the expert on this, that that's a sign of a profound behavioral disorder, something that needs to be treated. If that happened to a psychiatric patient in a hospital, they wouldn't be put into solitary confinement, though they'd be isolated. So it does strike me that there needs to be – I mean, is that the case? Are you looking at a profound behavioral disorder that needs to be treated as a psychiatric problem and not as a discipline problem? And, of course, you can see the problem. If you're a corrections officer, you're not trained to do mental health. You're trained to do the incarceration. So, Terry, I wonder if you can, you know, just respond to that briefly.
Well, the reality is that we all do both. Mental health professionals in corrections need to know a lot about security or they can't provide mental health treatment. And unfortunately, the custody staff need to know a lot about mental health because a lot of the prisoners are troubled with mental illness. I would just encourage you to think about the future. Yes, in the immediate present time, it might seem the best option to put someone who is violent or dangerous in an isolative setting. But then as the clock turns in the future, we have to release them. And one of the big problems nationwide is that people are kept in isolation to prevent violence while they're in prison with that particular individual. And then their term finishes. And they're released into the community. That's the most dangerous situation imaginable. And just such a person murdered the Commissioner of Corrections in Colorado a few years ago. So we need to be thinking about the long-term effect of isolation, and it's extremely damaging and actually increases the likelihood of violence. And then we need to come back to the present and keep that in consideration. And that's why I say we need to do separation with programs rather than isolation.
I want to continue our conversation about solitary confinement with Terry Coopers, a psychologist with the Institute of the Right Institute. Deborah Weissman is a UNC law professor and lead author of Solitary Confinement as Torture. And Art Beeler is with us, former warden at the Butner Federal Correction Complex in North Carolina. And our conversation will continue on the state of things right after this. Stay tuned. We're examining solitary confinement today on the state of things, talking about solitary confinement. Is it torture? It is based on a new study from UNC's law school. It's called Solitary Confinement as Torture. Deborah Weissman is UNC law professor and the lead author. Terry Coopers is with us as well, a psychologist and institute professor at the Wright Institute. Art Beeler is with us, former warden at Butner's Federal Correctional Complex in Butner, North Carolina. Just before the break, Art Beeler, we were talking about, you know, sort of the mental health issues here and whether or not you're compounding the problem of somebody who's already got an issue by isolating them further and then releasing them into the environment. I know that's something you're working on now. I mean, how do you manage that? And is that something you're actually trying proactively to correct, and how?
Well, I think, yes, to answer your question in a short sell, yes. We've got to be able to be more creative, especially with the mentally ill, of getting them out of their cells for periods of hours during a week. North Carolina has actually started a process of getting people out of their cells at Central Prison that are mentally ill for up to 20 hours a week. It's not system-wide yet, but it is being worked on. North Carolina also has made a commitment to do transitional care units at all their closed custody institutions, and that's a step-down unit.
Well, I want to ask you to talk directly about something Terry Cooper said, though. This is somebody who you've identified within the institution as a serious problem. You put him in a situation which psychologists are telling you is going to make things worse, and then you're going to let them go. Doesn't that add urgency to this?
Well, first of all, if it was in my institution, if a psychologist told me that there was an issue there, they wouldn't stay there. But that's my institution.
The psychologist would stay. The individual wouldn't stay in solitary.
That's correct.
That's what you meant. Okay.
That's correct. But the real issue here is Dr. Coopers talks about releasing somebody directly from solitary. And you know, I'm not going to disagree with him in one iota there, is that if a person is getting ready to be released into the society, there's got to be some way to step them down in some method or some fashion that is secure to put them back into the general population.
But I did hear Dr. Cooper say the damage is permanent.
I'm not an expert there, and I'm not going to try to go into what he is or dispute what he says there. I know from a correctional standpoint, you still got to do it in a secure manner.
Deborah Weissman, that does seem to be the problem. The charge of correctional officers in an institution is to keep people incarcerated and keep them safe and society safe. And then there's mental health. Are these systems too divided in order to really create a kind of creative solution to this?
Well, I think you've really identified one of the main problems with solitary confinement, and that is the structural issues with regard to mental health. So we don't have a very good mental health system. It's not well-funded. It's not well-resourced. And so prisons have become, in many instances, the default treatment for mental health, individuals with mental health problems. On top of that, correctional officers do not have training with regard to mental health issues. They will identify the manifestation of mental health problems as prison disciplinary infractions. So the systems are interrelated because we have not done a good job with mental health. We also have additional problems with mental health in the prisons because of over-incarceration. So we have overpopulation, crowding, and we have a mentality about prisons and who goes to prison that is, it really lends itself to these dehumanizing practices. But with regard to the issues of mental health, there's no doubt that the systems are interrelated and they need to be both treated differently, separately. But where they come together, there has to be training, there has to be expertise, there has to be therapeutic settings. Mr. Beeler noted the new initiatives at Central Prison. From what we know, they are working. They are making some headway in reducing the you know, the violence and the disciplinary infractions. So we need to do more of that. I think by no means has Central Prison complied with the recommendations that have been made in previous audits and previous studies, but it is a step.
Is there any place in the country or the world that's doing it better and could stand as a model?
Well, that's an interesting question. There are some states that have been trying to do it differently and do it better, and how that develops is something that everybody's looking at and studying. I think the reforms are new, and it's a little bit too soon to know what's working. Maine is an example. Mississippi was an example for a while, but I think that there's been some recent sort of step back in terms of progress. Colorado has been held up as an example. But again, the folks who work very closely on the issue of prisoners and solitary confinement will say that it's just too soon to know what is working. No doubt there are some meaningful reforms underway.
All right. Well, I want to thank all of you for being on the program. Deborah Weissman, UNC law professor, the lead author of Solitary Confinement as Torture. You can find a link to that report at our website, stateofthings.org. Thank you for being on the program.
Thank you.
Terry Coopers is a psychologist and a professor at the Wright Institute. Terry Coopers, thanks for being on the program.
Thank you very much. Good program.
Art Beeler, former warden at Butner Federal Correction Complex in North Carolina. He is working to improve management of inmates with mental illness here in North Carolina. Art, thanks for your work and thanks for being on the program.
Thank you, Frank.
And thank you for listening to The State of Things. As I say, check out our website, stateofthings.org.